We now have the third of four oral arguments this morning. Judges Cochran and Cleary, join me, Judge Sleater, in this matter. We are recording the proceedings as well as live streaming, so we do ask counsel, when it's your turn to approach the podium, that you make sure to identify yourself for a record and inform us who you represent. We do ask that you keep an eye on the time clock, which is on the podium, and there also is a button on the podium to rise or lower it to your liking. And the file numbers for this matter, A240734, State of Minnesota Appellant versus Devin Dion Tillman, respondent. And counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may approach and proceed. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Scott Hersey, Special Assistant Blue Earth County Attorney representing the appellant, the State of Minnesota, in this sentencing appeal. It is well established that the burden of proof regarding jail credit and the amount of that credit is on the defendant. Under the Minnesota sentencing guidelines, the Minnesota criminal rules, and state statute, the award of jail credit is not discretionary. Over the past 40 years, the Minnesota Supreme Court has issued a number of decisions about jail credit for incarceration in another state on unrelated charges or convictions, and those include Bentley, Brown, Willis, and Linehan in the mid-80s, and more recently, State versus Roy in 2019. In each of those cases, our Supreme Court has consistently stated that jail credit for incarceration in another state is only allowed if that incarceration is solely in connection with the Minnesota charges. If a defendant is being held in the other state on its own charges as well, no jail credit is allowed. And this is the interjurisdictional jail credit rule, which is different from the intrajurisdictional rule, which is when all the cases involved are Minnesota cases. And the Minnesota Supreme Court has chosen to relax the standards for jail credit for intrajurisdictional cases, but it has not done so for interjurisdictional cases. And it reaffirmed this principle in 2019 in the Roy case, where it applied the interjurisdictional rule to deny jail credit.
Counsel, the law on interjurisdictional jail credit seems to be clearly articulated in the Roy case by the Supreme Court, and we of course are bound by Supreme Court precedent, and the district court is as well. But respondent offers a number of alternative legal arguments for affirming the district court besides the basis relied on by the district court, including that an argument based on equal protection. Is that argument properly before this court?
Well, I would point out, Judge, that in footnote 2 in Roy, the Minnesota Supreme Court declined to address the defendant's constitutional equal protection argument raised for the first time on appeal. And similarly, in State versus Johnson, cited for its persuasive value under Appellate Rule 13601, this court a little over 2 months ago declined to address the defendant's constitutional equal protection and due process arguments raised for the first time on appeal, and it distinguished Gruney when it did so. And I'm suggesting that this court should similarly decline to address those arguments here because, number one, they're raised for the first time on appeal, and I would submit that the Minnesota Supreme Court cases, which bind this court, including Roy, are the ones that govern the outcome of this case. And I would submit to the court that if this rule is going to be changed, that's within the authority of the Minnesota Supreme Court, not the Court of Appeals, to do so. And I would point out that the Minnesota Supreme Court has granted review in the Johnson case, and the review and the petition for review are on the same equal protection and due process issues respondent has raised here. And I did take a quick perusal of respondent's brief to the Court of Appeals in Johnson, and that's virtually identical to the brief respondent filed here with the same issues and with the same counsel. And I would suggest to the court that
granting of the PFR, in your view, how does that affect our analysis, if at all?
It does not. It does not. This court can rule as it deems appropriate.
Still bound by existing precedent.
But I submit that the court is still bound by the precedent of Roy and the multiple cases out of the mid-80s from the Minnesota Supreme Court, and that those would supersede any other cases because it's directly on point. So I'm asking the court to rule that at the present, that the binding authority of the Minnesota Supreme Court dictates that the interjurisdictional rules of Willis and Roy apply, and that the respondent is not entitled to 424 days of credit. And I am asking the court also to decline the invitation to address the equal protection and due process arguments.
What about the due process argument? I mean, that seems to be a little bit different argument than the, in other words, that is not based on jail credit so much as amount as an argument that the delay in sentencing resulted in
a denial of due process?
Well, it basically resulted in Mr. Tillman starting his sentence later than he should have for the Minnesota offense.
I would point out,
offenses.
Judge, that both Minnesota and Illinois are signatories to the Uniform Extradition Act. And Minnesota Statute 629.19 leaves it to the governor in the sending or asylum state to decide if the governor is going to allow a particular defendant to go to the receiving state temporarily to be tried on an outstanding charge, or if that governor in the asylum sending state is going to keep the person there, resolve that state's case, and in fact then make the person serve their sentence there before they release them to the requesting state. So I would submit that that has a significant impact, and that has not been addressed before this court.
The record then insufficient to review the due process argument? Because there really, based on my review of the record, there isn't much information about what occurred between when the waiver of extradition was signed and when Mr. Tillman was returned to Minnesota.
Right, and I would submit that the record I constructed was the best record I could get out of the record itself, and the burden of proof is on the respondent to prove that he is entitled to jail credit and exactly what that jail credit is. But I would still submit to the court that if the court looks at the transcript of the sentence in Minnesota, the district court did not follow the interjurisdictional rule. And in fact, I'm not sure that the district court actually followed the intrajurisdictional rule. It basically said, well, our warrant issued when he failed to appear for sentencing, so had he not been in custody in Illinois, he would have gotten credit for a number of days there or an equivalent amount of time. And that just doesn't square with anything, and I think that is an error of law. And so I'm asking the court to apply the Supreme Court precedent and deny that jail credit.
Counsel, I have a question. If Mr. Tillman had, through counsel, well, after his sentencing in Illinois, had notified Minnesota authorities that he wanted his sentence executed, what would have happened?
That is a specific area of law where he may well have received some credit at that point. But that has to do with the Minnesota statute where a defendant has the right, depending on the time frame of time that the defendant has to serve, where the defendant has the right to demand execution of a probationary sentence. Those are not the facts that face us in this particular case, Judge. So that may have allowed additional credit, but we are not facing that issue, and I'm not sure that we have to answer that question.
The whole issue is you don't want to turn what normally would be concurrent sentences into consecutive ones. I mean, that's the theory and the concern, and that's the constitutional arguments, I believe. I'll go to that issue, which is if this would normally be concurrent, but due to the prosecutors in two states making some decisions leading to consecutive sentencing, almost taking it out of the court's hands that way. What can we do to change that? Now, the sentences are very similar. Weren't they 3 years in each jurisdiction? So my understanding, and I realize he didn't show up for sentencing in Minnesota, but had he shown up, I guess now we're getting into speculation, I get that. But had he shown up, I think he'd have a right then to execute that prison sentence against the time, and thereby making those concurrent sentences.
He may well have done that with a demand for execution, but as the court will see from the record, we don't have that situation here. Okay. We do not have that situation here.
Well, I think his mistake wasn't he didn't get to Minnesota sentencing, because I think he could have requested that once he'd been sentenced in Minnesota.
Yes. Once he was sentenced in Minnesota, he certainly could have requested that. But again, I'm suggesting that the court declined to address the constitutional issues and follow Johnson. And if the court does so, I think it's almost a given that there will be a petition for review from the respondent. And it's highly likely, considering the status of the Johnson case, and considering that the equal protection and due process arguments made in both cases are virtually identical, that the Supreme Court will grant review and will stay that in this appeal pending its decision in Johnson. And I would suggest to the court that that would be an appropriate manner of resolving this. And that will allow the Supreme Court the benefit to exercise its authority to decide the continued viability of the interjurisdictional geocredit rule and to decide the constitutional issues, should it choose to do so, that are being raised in that appeal to the Minnesota Supreme Court. So that would give the chance for the court to rule in two cases with identical procedure postures, and that is what I'm asking the court to rule in this case. And unless there are...
Just to clarify, counsel, then, under that scenario, if we did that and... the Johnson case, Supreme Court rules in favor of counsel's client in that case, then would it necessarily resolve it, or would it remand to us to then consider it based on that new precedent?
They could do either, Judge. If they granted review and stayed it, they could perhaps just issue an opinion order following Johnson, or they could remand it here for this court to simply follow Johnson. Either way, the result would be the same, and that would fairly dramatically change about 40 years of Supreme Court jurisprudence. But I think procedurally that may be the way to consider this case. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you'll now have 15 minutes of response.
May it please the court. My name is Richard Schmitz. I represent respondent Devin Tillman. I wanted to start by answering some factual questions or some stuff I think needs clarification before I begin my argument. First off, on the Johnson case, the Supreme Court did grant the PFR, but there were two PFRs. One was on the special term opinion, the published opinion on whether or not you can challenge jail credit on a state appeal from a probation order. That was granted. The court did an amended order clarifying that they did not grant on the second PFR. That second PFR is still pending on whether or not the equal protection arguments and due process arguments should be ruled on. It has not been ruled on one way or the other, so it's still pending. In terms of the judge did not give him jail credit for any time before February 2nd of 23, so the way the judge articulated and implied that is not the case. The math shows there's 14 months of jail credit given. That's consistent with his date of arrest in Illinois, and it's consistent with his date of when he requested extradition. So there's no extra time on EHM or out of custody time that he got. Third, as a factual, on the date of the original sentencing hearing, May 23rd, 22, he didn't show up because he was on EHM and Illinois pretrial release, so he couldn't leave. That was the reason. He did go out on warrant on both Minnesota and Illinois matter in June of 22. In terms of the arguments in the respondent's brief, I want to take them out of order and actually argue backwards. I want to put a highlight and a clear focus on the simplest, easiest, and most narrow argument to affirm the district court's decision. And the premise of the state's argument is that there's a bright line rule that you only get jail credit under the interjurisdictional rule if and only if the confinement was solely in connection with the Minnesota matter. It's not true. We cited to the Bauman case and the Haddu case in our brief. Both cases, post-Willis, post-Brown, held that the defendant was entitled to jail credit for time served in another sovereign's custody based on discretionary delay of the state and discretionary decisions of the state. And in the appellant's brief, they cited to this unpublished case, Drilling, which distinguished Bauman based on some sort of federal and state distinction. That's been abrogated by Roy. There is no difference between state out-of-state time and federal time. They're both viewed under the interjurisdictional rule. And Bauman factually looks a lot like the facts of this case. And Bauman has not been overruled. It has not been abrogated. It is a published decision of this court and should control the outcome in this case. Factually, why it's like Bauman is the judge was looking at a plea agreement here for 36 months and did not want to turn a sentence into a consecutive sentence. There are sources of authority from this court that support the granting of credit under these circumstances. So on March 14th, 2022, Tillman pleaded guilty. All parties knew at the plea hearing that he was on EHM in Illinois on new charges, pretrial release. The warrant was issued on May 23rd, 2022, when he didn't appear for sentencing because he was on EHM and couldn't appear in person. There's no bar to a defendant serving his Minnesota sentence in another sovereign's prison. There's no bar to Blue Earth County picking Tillman up when he was on EHM to get him sentenced. There's no bar to doing a sentencing hearing by Zoom. Blue Earth County chose not to get Tillman. They chose not to sentence Tillman. So that's a discretionary.
We don't really have anything in the record that shows. Going back to Bauman, factually, that's a little different case than we have here, I believe. In Bauman, there was another federal sentence at issue, correct?
This case has even more, I would say, generous facts for the granting of credit. In Bauman, the defendant had not even pled guilty on the federal matter at the time that he was arrested or brought to federal prison. Here, Tillman already had pled guilty and was just waiting to be sentenced. So Blue Earth County at any point, and especially, and you said the record isn't clear. The record is clear.
An order for a concurrent sentence in Bauman.
The agreement was, because it wasn't, he hadn't been sentenced yet on the Illinois matter at the time of sentence on the Blue Earth County matter. And if there was, at the time that it was made into a de facto consecutive sentence, the judge was trying to honor the plea agreement for a 36-month sentence, not turn it into a consecutive sentence.
Well, and in Bauman, the federal custody delayed the arraignment in the state case, correct?
Correct. Same is true here. He was stuck in Illinois on EHM on pretrial release and therefore could not come to Minnesota for the sentencing hearing. So Blue Earth County waited for him to finish his Illinois time before getting him sentenced. And then they come to this court and request an extra 14 months.
We don't have much in the record, though, to show. All we know, you say Blue Earth County waited for him to finish his sentence, but we don't actually know what occurred in between from the record. We just know he signed the waiver of extradition and he was returned to Minnesota. We don't know what Blue Earth County did in between.
Review the PSI, Your Honor, and you'll see that he was released from Illinois March 8th, 24. He had pleaded guilty in Illinois, and the extradition waiver was from an Illinois prison February 2nd, 23.
Right, but we don't know that. You say Blue Earth County just sat by and did nothing.
I've represented defendants multiple times by Zoom on sentencing hearings when they're out of state, and that occurred while they're still serving their other state sentence. Just represented a defendant in Wisconsin at a sentencing hearing. He was in Wisconsin prison. We did a Zoom hearing. He wanted to get sentenced after he signed that extradition waiver.
But counsel, I did review the PSI, and what I'm trying to focus on is, for the due process, for us to review the due process argument, we need a record about what the reason for the delay was. And I don't see enough specifics here for us to review that. So help me understand why I'm wrong.
February 2nd, 2023, Tillman's in prison in Illinois. He signs an extradition waiver while he's in prison in Illinois. At that point, the state was on notice that he wanted to be sentenced, and Blue Earth County did nothing. They waited for him to complete his Illinois sentence. That's in the record. They did nothing. So there wasn't some affirmative thing that the state did that I can point to. It was inaction, so I can't point to anything. They did nothing.
But there's no evidence that he asked to be sentenced in Minnesota once he signed the waiver.
That is the point of the signing the waiver of extradition, so he could appear to Minnesota to resolve his Minnesota matter.
Counsel, are you aware of any case law on that very issue, the signing of the waiver?
I would say that I can't point to a source of authority that says that, but that's what Tillman intended by signing the waiver.
I understand what's intended by signing the waiver. I just wonder if you were able to find any cases.
No, I did not find a case.
The signing of the waiver puts, you know, an obligation to, on behalf of the state that needs to extradite, whether they have an obligation then to act.
I want to circle back to something Your Honor pointed out, that had it been a probation matter like the Johnson case, that there would have been a right for a Randolph request and that it needed to be acted on. So there is no, as far as I know, comparable analog for somebody who's pled guilty and hasn't been sentenced yet. I cannot think of a case that says that, like Randolph.
But going back to Judge Cleary's question, I know this isn't exactly on point, but under the interstate agreement on detainers, the defendant has the obligation to make a request. So why wouldn't a similar rule apply here?
My understanding of the interstate agreement on detainers is it deals with unresolved cases. He had pled guilty but had not been sentenced. My understanding is he can't invoke that. I couldn't say I'm 100% on that, but because he had pleaded guilty, it was not unresolved at the time.
I understand that, but what I'm asking is why shouldn't the defendant ask to have be sentenced once he signs that waiver of extradition?
I would say that there's no other vehicle to try to get sentenced other than signing the waiver of extradition. If he had money to hire a private attorney or the public defender's office had point people to try to deal with out-of-state cases like this, perhaps he could have reached out that way, but he has no knowledge and no income and no ability to access the levers of power to make that happen, which is one of the problems with the interjurisdictional rule.
Go ahead, sir.
Isn't it true, Counsel, just to clarify, because you started out the quick and easiest way for us to affirm was, as I recall, but isn't it true that unless we address your constitutional arguments, which and the Johnson court similarly found that they had, since not raised below, were forfeited. But unless we do that, you don't dispute that the record is clear that he was not in Illinois solely, being held solely for a Minnesota charge, so the interjurisdictional rule would suggest we reverse.
I don't agree with the conclusion, but I agree with everything you said factually regarding he was serving an Illinois sentence when he was in custody in Illinois, except for 10 days at the end when he was waiting extradition.
How do we affirm without addressing constitutional issues despite the interjurisdictional rule?
Under the Bauman case and the Hadgu case, both of those cases are published Court of Appeals cases, post-Willis, post-Brown. They have nothing to do with applying the interjurisdictional rule as far as a bright line.
Not post-Roy, though.
Roy,
2019.
Roy did not abrogate or overrule Bauman or Hadgu. So this court has the ability to apply principles of fairness and equity. My opponent argues otherwise, but under those cases, this court doesn't even have to deal with the interjurisdictional rule. If it looks at Bauman and says it's very similar, cite to Bauman, the judge did not err in granting the credit. That's the end of the case. I want to talk about Grunig and the Jason Johnson case cited to in the supplemental authorities. We properly invoke the rule of Grunig, and this court in the Johnson case created an exception to Grunig that does not exist in Grunig. It created an exception that is shockingly unfair in an adversarial system. where your opponent's non-response to an argument waives your argument. So respondent forfeits an argument because the appellant doesn't respond to the argument. That's not in Grunig. I don't know where this court got that from, but it's not fair that an opponent's non-action can waive an argument. This is the equal protection argument is a novel argument,
but
that's based.
I agree, and I you know, you raised some good points in your equal protection argument, but we are an error correcting court, and we are bound by Roy. So, on what basis can we consider the equal protection argument given Roy?
Roy was the appellant in the case and asked to do the argument, not the respondent. So Grunig didn't apply. In this case, Mr. Tillman's the respondent. This is a novel argument, hasn't been addressed before, and this court is, as nobody that I know of has ever.
But the rule is clear in Roy, and you're asking us to abrogate the rule.
No litigant has ever challenged the interjurisdictional rule on equal protection grounds. It is a good faith, novel argument for an extension of the law, and there is no bar to a respondent using the existing record to making a novel argument for affirmance. Just because it hasn't been ruled on doesn't mean that it lacks validity or shouldn't be ruled on by this court. This court is faced with novel arguments all the time in a variety of issues and has to address them because they haven't been argued before. The equal protection argument is a novel argument. There's no cases saying, Tillman's wrong, the respondent's wrong on it. And if this court doesn't feel Baumann controls, it does have to reach the due process argument, and it does have to reach the equal protection argument. In terms of the equal protection argument, the primary feature in the fundamentally flawed the interjurisdictional rule is that it acts asymmetrically. So you have two people serving time, one in Fargo, one in Moorhead. One gets the time, one doesn't, both serving unrelated matters. That's just unfair at a fundamental level. But it's even asymmetrical at the macro level because in Minnesota, we allow people to serve their Minnesota sentence in another sovereign's prison. So it creates this incentive to plead guilty as quickly as possible and get sentenced as quickly as possible, which makes no sense as well. If Minnesota actually believed that there's a reason that you shouldn't allow interjurisdictional time, we wouldn't see the ability to serve your Minnesota sentence in another sovereign's prison. It's also inconsistent with the guidelines in terms of there's no carve-out in the guidelines for out-of-state convictions being first. The consecutive sentence rules apply whether or not the older sentence is from another state, another jurisdiction or not. So if you look at the Johnson case and the rules that we are the interest that they want to promote through jail credit, the interjurisdictional rule contradicts every single one of them. It ensures and requires de facto consecutive sentencing. It's a rule of law that harms indigent people. It rewards manipulation by the prosecution to wait and not take care of cases. I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, you'll now have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. I would point out that as respondent argued in his brief that the Minnesota Supreme Court in its series of decisions on the interjurisdictional rule in the mid-80s and also in its fairly recent decision in 2019 didn't go through a thorough enough analysis. But the fact that the Minnesota Supreme Court may have not expounded on this issue extensively doesn't make its ruling go away. And I think it is still applicable here, and I would ask the court to follow it.
Counsel, can you address respondent's argument about the Baumann case?
With the Baumann case, I don't think that is clearly analysis. It's not a clear analogy to our particular case. There have been a couple of situations where the appellate courts in Minnesota have decided that beyond the interjurisdictional and intrajurisdictional issue, there may be other issues where they may step outside that box and perhaps grant credit. And they've done that when there has been the secret hold in one case by a prosecutor, which was clearly trying to manipulate the amount of time There was another case where I think the INS placed a hold immediately when someone was about to bail out. Again, it's the manipulation of the system in cases like that. And I think that's the same principle that comes up in Bauman. But we simply don't have that here, and we don't have a clear record, which is the respondent's burden, to show what happened in Illinois. And I would point out very quickly that I agree with counsel that the interstate agreement on detainers can't be invoked in this case because this is a situation where we don't have an untried detainer. This is one where the defendant, before he failed to appear at sentencing, pled guilty to two felonies, and in the guilty plea transcript, the district court did accept those, so it's not an untried indictment. Counsel mentioned in his argument that this court has the authority to apply fairness and equity in this particular case, and that is the more expansive view of the Minnesota Supreme Court for intra-jurisdictional cases, and it appears the counsel is urging this court to sidestep some of the decisions of the Minnesota Supreme Court and take into account the de facto consecutive concern of the Supreme Court in interjurisdictional cases and just their general fairness and equity concepts that they have built into that. And the Minnesota Supreme Court has declined to do that. They have maintained that original rule. And I would submit additionally that this court need not address every issue that the parties raise, especially if one issue is dispositive. And with the 40-year history of the interjurisdictional rule, I think that that is the dispositive jurisprudence of the Minnesota Supreme Court, and I'm asking the court to follow that. And I would just point out on the issue of making something de facto consecutive when Minnesota, in the sentencing guidelines and elsewhere in law, presumes concurrent sentences except for the exceptions in the sentencing guidelines. Other states have other statutes, other rules, other procedures, and they may not have determinate sentencing, and they may not have laws that presume that sentences are to be concurrent. And if we were just to adopt wholesale respondents' argument, we would, in Minnesota, be attempting to make up for the fact that another jurisdiction may have laws that make sentences consecutive, and we would make ours fully concurrent with theirs to make up for their having different procedures. And I think the interjurisdictional rule basically respects the sovereignty of another state to make its own rules. And unless there are further questions, I will conclude. Thank you.
Well, appears to be none. Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your comments today and answers to our questions as well as briefing. We now take the matter under advisement, and we wish a ruling within 90 days. Have a good day.